Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Tomorrow night at the Schomburg Center in Harlem, WNYC's Rebecca Carroll will host an event based on the WNYC series she produced called Dear President, What You Need to Know About Race. And listeners, some of you will remember we had five Dear President essayists on this show for conversations after their original pieces ran on Morning Edition. We'll replay an excerpt from one that Rebecca has chosen in just a minute. The Schomburg event will have a cool format. It's three micro-conversations with different guests, and we will preview one of those micro-conversations now with WNYC's Rebecca Carroll and the poet Kevin Young, who recently became the director of the Schomburg Center, or as it's fully known, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, part of the New York Public Library. Their micro-conversation is called The Extra Work We Do as Black Folks. Hi, Rebecca. And Kevin Young, welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show. So wait, who's hosting who tomorrow night?
Right.
You're the host of the event,
yes.
But you're a guest in his building.
That's right. And just to clarify, his micro-conversation is actually in conversation with multimedia artist Beate Ross Smith.
Oh.
So you're curating that part. I curate and I introduce and sort of provide the interstitial connective tissue between the micro-conversations. And just to clarify a little bit, because it's kind of confusing, the micro-conversations are something that I developed that pair two kind of interesting people who are meeting for the first time.
Huh.
No pre-interviews. And I provide a theme, and they sort of lead with curiosity and have like a 10 to 12-minute conversation. And so for these purposes, it's sort of like incremental term, and it's sort of that big conversation about race, that uncomfortable conversation that everyone's always saying we should have in incremental terms. So it's like a sort of listen-in, kitchen table conversation.
Wrestling match.
Yeah. Hopefully not.
So wait, who's he paired with who we never met before?
Beate Ross Smith.
Are you nervous?
No. I can take anyone.
And, you know, I'm interested in that idea, Rebecca, that the big conversation that everybody says we always need to have about race maybe is best broken up into micro conversations, because you don't get anywhere. I mean, sometimes you can, but big thing, it gets so overarching, it gets so unspecific to people's lives. So micro conversations is probably a fabulous idea.
I really think that it provides, you know, people who are watching and also people who are in the conversations, it's giving them an opportunity to kind of bring who they are and how they think to the table in a kind of without judgment and with mutual respect. And also, if they leave the conversation knowing a little bit more or feeling a little bit more informed, it could change their next encounter on the sidewalk or in their office.
And it makes the big thing feel less overwhelming.
Right.
So, for example, you brought a clip from the Dear President essay that you'll play at the Schomburg Center tomorrow night to start the conversation. Want to set this up?
Yeah, this is an essay by the very great Damon Young of Very Smart Brothers, and it's called Nigger Neurosis, and it's about a kind of affliction that most black people feel in many encounters that we have on a daily basis.
And this excerpt is about 1 minute long.
Black people live in a perpetual state of wondering if and how our race is involved when we experience anything. I live with my wife and our 10-month-old daughter in a middle to upper middle class neighborhood in Pittsburgh. It's a type of neighborhood that blocks off its streets once a year for a house and garden tour, where people open up their homes and allow strangers to hang out inside of them. This is easily the whitest block I've ever lived on, which is saying a lot because I lived in Pittsburgh, the white person's Atlanta, my entire life. We rent a house near a popular neighborhood pub. Between the pub and our house is a fire hydrant. The other day, as I was parked maybe 7 or 8 feet from the hydrant, a white man standing outside of the bar gestured at me to roll down my window. hey, man, you got to back up some. I'm a retired firefighter. You got to be at least 15 feet away from the hydrant. I took a moment to consider who he is. A middle-aged white guy who says he's a retired firefighter. Where I'm parked, 7 feet from the hydrant, which is technically illegal, but a law that is broken literally every day on this block. Where I am, remember, this is peak white Pittsburgh. Who's with me, my infant daughter, and who I am, a black guy, before deciding how to respond and what to do. This is Nigga Neurosis.
Did you think twice, Rebecca, as curator of this series, about including the N-word, even that version of the N-word, on WNYC?
No, I didn't. I feel like, particularly one at the dinner of the presidential that Larry Wilmore hosted,
the correspondence dinner
when Larry Wilmore said to President Obama, "You did it, my nigga." You know, it was a moment where two black men saw two black men, and I feel like I have had mixed feelings about that word, but both with the A and the ER at the end. I'm raising a son who hears that, and so I have mixed feelings about it. But I know when I hear it, when it is what the intentions are. I know when I hear it, I can sense when it's being used in a way that is okay. I mean, for lack of a better explanation.
Kevin, you want to react to that clip? Was that the first time you heard it, or no?
I had read the clip, the piece, which I think is a really interesting piece. I have a slightly different take on the N-word, but we needn't get too far into that.
No, I don't want to get bogged down in that.
Yeah,
but
because I think context is everything. I think you're absolutely right on that. You know, and I'm really happy we're having this conversation tomorrow up at Schomburg, an all-black setting that, you know, really has created and contained and kept the context of black culture and arts alive. So I think it's a really interesting question. And going back to what you were saying about dailiness, I think that's very much in the forefront of my mind. I mean, every day we're thinking about those kind of aspects of culture. And I'm really happy to see the sort of fruit of that in the piece. I mean, I think it is a nuanced piece, thinking about, you know, is it internal, is it external? I won't give away the end of what happens, but, you know, he has a kind of revelation, I think, about, you know, how much is in my head and how much is external. And
well, I think we can give it away to the extent that the issue that it raises, the tension that he raises, because we played the whole piece on this show previously and had Damon on to talk about it, is that this is something that he feels he needs to live with all the time. The neurosis is not knowing whether some white person is actually discriminating against you or doing something that's treating you equally but looks to you like it's discriminating against you because there's so much actual discrimination against you, if I'm summarizing it right.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the power of racism, right? And because how will we ever actually know?
Well, it's the old gem, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you. I mean, there's a level of that going on. But, you know, I think what I think is most powerful is that he's writing about it. There's something about that written word trying to contend with that those weird interactions that you have. And, you know, I think a book like Citizen, which really thinks about these sort of microaggressions and our micro conversations, are really interesting, the ways in which in those little slip moments, we find out a lot about someone's point of view or what they might mean or what might not be in their heart but is in their subconscious.
But I also think that beyond the writing aspect of it, which, of course, as writers, we both value and think that that's really important, but I think what is great about these micro-conversations is that and I don't know about the Schomburg audience specifically, but I know that there will be some white folks in the audience but who probably don't think about this or it would not have occurred to them. And so
that
informs them in a way that even though it's a 10, 12-minute conversation, the next time they're on the sidewalk at dusk.
Great point.
And a black person's walking towards them.
Maybe they'll think
They'll think differently.
Listeners, want to call in and share your experiences that Damon Young might have just given voice to there? 212-433-WNYC or anything else you want to ask Rebecca Carroll or Kevin Young or add to this conversation with? 212-433-9692. And Kevin, I know you've also agreed to read something of yours for us. I was lucky enough to hear you recite a couple of things at another New York Public Library event recently. It was great. So what you got today?
Yeah, I thought I'd read a poem called Ode to the Harlem Globetrotters. Obviously, the Schomburg is right there in Harlem on 135th and Malcolm X Boulevard. And growing up, I used to see the Harlem Globetrotters in many different places, including the Midwest, and they always played the Washington Generals. And as a young person, I was always amazed how they would beat them every time. Ode to the Harlem Globetrotters. Because they always win. Because Meadowlark Lemon. Because for them, double dribbling is literal. Because on your finger, your knee, toes, and elbows, the world can spin. Because the ball on a string. Because rubber bands for hands. Because the ball a banner. Because where else do generals meet defeat without blood? Because the best offense is a quick de-pantsing. Because mercy, not pity. Because the bucket of water tossed on the cries of the crowd turns like tears to confetti.
Fun. So were you just having fun with your fun Harlem Globetrotters memory? Or is there a deeper meaning there?
For me, yeah, I was thinking about, you know, the sort of pride of the Globetrotters and the way that, you know, they began as such an interesting troop of really talented ballplayers who then, you know, merged that talent and entertainment in a black setting and, you know, really brought sort of, they were ambassadors, I think, of Harlem and style and uptown and grace. But also the sort of pain that they're of that at the ending, I hope, sort of thinks about, you know, how you can turn your own tears to confetti and how sort of things that seem serious can be playful and how we can think about race as a given, as something that, you know, you can play with and improvise on.
Sheila in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Brian. Yesterday I was shopping with my daughter at the mall, and we happened to go in a place where they were selling makeup, and a young black girl was assisting us. And from the back, there were two other people older who were working in the store. I believe they were the managers. And the way they were staring at us made me feel so uncomfortable. There was no smile, nothing to really make me feel comfortable. They were checking us, especially that the girl who was helping us was black. And, it was my day with my daughter, and I tried to make it, you know, make her feel comfortable by not making any comment and being nice to the girl who was assisting us. But I tried to brush it off, but it was still there. It accumulated from one store to the other to just ignore it. Because, you know, if I didn't do that, I would spend my day always saying, why are you watching me? Why are you doing this? Yeah. But the accumulation is there, no matter what we do.
So it's like in the Damon Young poem, you're questioning whether you're being neurotic and looking too much at how somebody's looking at you or don't know what else to do with it?
Well, I usually say hi. I try to introduce myself, but I was with my daughter. I didn't want to make her feel uncomfortable.
What race is the caller?
Yeah. So
you're asking what?
I was asking what race are you or do you identify as?
Oh, I'm Haitian. I'm black. All and right. I was raised in Canada. So my view is totally different.
Yeah.
The way I interact in stores and with people here. So we don't have a difference, a word for, other than racist. For racist, we don't use the word prejudice, even though it does exist in French, but we say racist.
Right.
You know, racism is racism. Whether you're black or white. So,
what are you thinking, Kevin?
I mean, I think negotiating these public spaces is always can be tricky, you know,
uh-huh.
and there are often these. It can feel very monitored as a space. I mean, you know, retail experiences can be a little different. Whether you're followed by the security guard or just sort of ask for your ID when you give your credit card when the guy in front of you isn't. I mean, there's a lot of little things that happen, but I think the broader sort of question is interesting because just to think about the essay, the Damon piece, you know, she's talked about from store to store it kind of grew and negotiating it with her daughter. I think that's the part we have to start really talking about and thinking about is the sort of inner monologue and the way that she's trying to deal with it with raising a child. And, you know, how do you talk about this thing that is everywhere but also nowhere? I mean, I think that's part of the difficulty, the invisibility.
Sheila, thank you for calling. And we'll continue in a minute with WNYC's Rebecca Carroll and Kevin Young, director of the Schomburg Center. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with WNYC's Rebecca Carroll and Kevin Young, who is the new director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, part of the New York Public Library in Harlem. And we'll get back to your phone calls in a minute. But Kevin, Rebecca suggested that I ask you about being a poet who also works as an arts administrator. So, Rebecca, you could probably frame this question better than me. Did you have something in mind?
Well, I'm thinking in terms of the election and President Trump, and who's clearly not that interested in preserving the arts very ardently. And, you know, also we're coming off of a year of tremendous, extraordinary black art. So I'm just wondering, what are the emergency meetings you're having right now?
Well, I think it's an interesting moment in the arts. I mean, just the Oscars were announced yesterday, and you saw, you know, a very, I think, positive sign in recognizing actors of color. And I thought that was really exciting. You know, I myself have held an NEA grant, and, you know, I'm currently, my book of hours is an NEA big read. So I think the NEA, I mean, you know, perhaps selfishly, but also knowing the amount of support it's given is so important. So I'm really hopeful that that stays the course and can really blossom. I think you're absolutely right, too, that there's this interesting kind of renaissance, and we're seeing it at Schomburg. We were lucky just a couple weeks ago to get named a National Historic Landmark. And so we're 92 years old. We're just celebrating our birthday. And Arturo Schomburg, who was our founder, you know, his birthday, I think, was yesterday. So we have this kind of interesting convergence up at Schomburg, thinking about, you know, celebrating and marking this moment, one of history when we're looking back, but also one of the arts and the real boom in black arts, whether it's films like Moonlight or you know, my boy Colson Whitehead's book, Underground Railroad, you know, really, I think, rich.
I saw the Kerry James Marshall exhibit last night.
Unbelievable.
Which is just extraordinary.
You know,
and I was curious, since you succeed the historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad, who has taken a position at Harvard as head of the Schomburg Center, is it different to have a poet versus a historian in charge?
Well, I, having not been a historian, I'm not sure, but I think it does tell us a little bit about the range of the Schomburg's holdings. I mean, we really, you know, started in the midst of the Harlem Renaissance in the 20s, and, you know, that rich heritage is there, whether it's the Langston Hughes Auditorium and Lobby that's there, or thinking about, you know, the real range of arts and artifacts that is a whole division there, the photographs, Malcolm X, you know, seeing Malcolm X personal photographs, you know, his in the temple praying is so different than the images you get, and that's the kind of stuff you can see at the Schomburg.
I think it should also be noted that Kevin's work, his poetry, it has a major historical through line. I mean, he draws on the history of this country quite a bit in his work.
The Book of Hours, H-O-U-R-S, being your most recent award-winning book of poetry. I just thought I'd say that. Margaret in Elizabeth, you're on WNYC. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good, thanks for calling.
Yeah, absolutely. First and foremost, I just want to thank you so much for your dedication to free and accessible media. I think that it's so important, and in fact, it inspired me to donate my car to WNYC.
Your car, wow.
With this administration. Yeah, absolutely. And then I'm not
Thank
too
you.
Sure if we're too far from the topic, because I love where your conversation is going, but I wanted to circle back to this idea of neurosis.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really interesting because I understand, I mean, my point of view is from myself, which is a white female, and I'm a young educator, but I work in the inner city schools, and a large population of my class is either Latino, Latina, Hispanic, or Black. And I find that, especially dealing with, I don't want to say punishment, but more so discipline, I always have to continuously, like, check myself before I wreck myself in that sense of this idea of cultural dissonance. And if I am judging behavior based on what I grew up with versus, I mean, their experience in their home life in the inner cities, I'm from the suburbs.
So for you, this is sort of the corollary white person's neurosis, like being unsure whether you're perceiving actual behavior that needs to be disciplined or whether you're seeing things through a white person's gaze.
Right. I mean, and I hate to like take the term and like whitewash it or make it mine. But this idea that am I treating them, my students, am I treating my students fairly as I would a student that I saw myself in? And then I hate to say that, too, because I can see myself mm-hmm. in all of them, and I shouldn't see myself. I see them as who they are, but I hope you understand what I'm getting at.
Sure. Well, it's another way at the similar complexity of race relations at a micro-individual level. Rebecca, what are you thinking?
I would say, I would suggest to the caller that rather than internalizing that into your own neurosis, to explore it with your students, because the more that you internalize it, the more it contributes to the power that you hold over these kids. So,
with
you know,
a kid, how would she express it, do you think?
Well, I would say, you know, it's important that I think about how I reprimand or how I discipline you. And there are reasons for that because of the way that the system is stacked. And I am, you know, I am working on my own self-awareness about that. And that doesn't mm-hmm. take away from, you know, who I am as the person who's in charge of this classroom. But I think it's important to let you all know that I am taking this into consideration and that you should, you know, feel, you know, mm-hmm. share some of that power.
Margaret, briefly, because we're going to run out of time.
Absolutely. I just wanted to say thank you. I think that's great and a cornerstone to the democratic education approach. So I think that's wonderful to make it a process.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We just have 2 minutes left in the show. I want to touch on a couple of things that you're doing, Rebecca. I know you have an essay in the new book, The Meaning of Michelle.
Yeah.
The Huffington Post had a one-paragraph excerpt that they tagged as Rebecca Carroll on Michelle as a politician. Is that what you were going for?
No,
if you can give us a soundbite version.
It actually wasn't at all. It was much more on Michelle Obama as a resolute Black woman rooted in humor and graciousness and self-awareness. And I likened her to the Black writer Zora Neale Hurston, who loves herself when she's laughing and then again when she's looking mean and impressive.
And I see you'll be doing a green space event interviewing the newly Oscar-nominated filmmaker Raoul Peck, who made the feature-length documentary called I Am Not Your Negro. That's February 3rd in the green space in your series How I Got Over. Want to say, again, just in soundbite form, I'm sorry to say, what you think is important about the film or Raoul Peck as a director?
I think that the film itself is sort of collagist. Peck took James Baldwin's words, a manuscript that was unfinished, and sort of threaded it together with voiceover and actual clips of James Baldwin, who is just so magic. His voice, the tenor is gorgeous and so critical of what he was saying then in terms of what's happening now.
WNYC's Rebecca Carroll, thank you both for coming on.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With me now is Hugh Hewitt, the syndicated radio host heard locally on AM 970 and an NBC News and MSNBC commentator. He has worked in the Reagan administration, helped Richard Nixon, Dan Quayle, and Mitt Romney write books, and worked for the National Endowment for the Humanities and the California Arts Council, among other things. He's a Republican who calls President Obama's policies disastrous, but also called on Donald Trump to quit the campaign after the Access Hollywood tape came out in October, but has come back around to thinking he has the potential for a great presidency. And Hugh Hewitt is a big thinker on the issues, and he has a new book called The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. We'll explore his Fourth Way philosophy and talk about the news. Hugh, thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Brian, I'm really honored. I just put out a tweet saying, you've been doing this as long as I have. I started in radio in 1989, and you're a pros pro and a Peabody winner, and it's very nice of you to have me. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the directness and lack of sort of confrontational hyperbole with which you approach cable TV. We need more of that.
Thank you.
Can we enter at the point when you called on Trump to drop out? You had also said previously that Trump was flying the party into the side of a mountain when he attacked Judge Curiel just for being Mexican-American. Obviously, you didn't want Hillary Clinton to become president. So what was going through your mind at that moment that you called on Trump to drop out?
This was an extraordinary year, culminating in that moment and then culminating in an election night. If there was a concussion protocol for the media, we'd all still be in it, like the NFL. I always swore to support the party nominee. I was a debate participant for four of the debates. So I was Switzerland throughout the primaries. I never endorsed anybody. And so I endorsed Mr. Trump. When he attacked Judge Curiel, when he was Mr. Trump, now he's President Trump, I said, that's the plane into the mountain. You can't attack a federal judge based on ethnicity. I'm a lawyer, and I understood that. Then he stopped. And so I went out and I campaigned for him. Access Hollywood jarred me. I suggested he get out of the race. I called on him to get out of the race. When he didn't, I said I'd vote for him. And I did. I may have been the only person in NBC and 30 Rock on the night of the election to have voted for Donald Trump. And I am happy with the way he is governing, though stylistically, I have a lot of changes I would suggest to him. I think he's going to get better at this, Brian, and I am hopeful.
Your framing of a political fourth way is a riff on the third way, one of the nicknames for President Bill Clinton's brand of being a new Democrat in the 90s. You're harshly critical of the third way movement in the book. Why
is
that?
Because I thought it really concealed a genuine leftism with sugar coating. Bill Clinton was as liberal as President Obama turned out to be, but he sugarcoated it much better than President Obama did. President Obama was honest and absolutely direct about what he wanted to do. And like Corbyn in Great Britain, was a third-way leader who said, no, we're actually going back to FDR and we're going to build the government.
Corbyn is like the Bernie Sanders of the UK, right?
Yes, he's authentically a socialist. And to a certain extent, the march that was so vastly successful on Saturday here and in Washington across the country was a third-way march with a first-way core. It was run by first-way Democrats, big government Democrats, but it drew in a lot of people who were upset by Donald Trump, so it was a third-way march. The fourth way says to the president and to the Republicans, co-opt the center, go for the center, grab it, hang on to it, and build a lasting majority.
Right. And you knock it in the book as elitist, but a Clinton supporter would say it wasn't about elitism at all or sugarcoating, you know, real lefty policies, but about Democrats acknowledging at that time that conservatives got some things right, that crime was out of control, that too much socialism and too much protectionism really did hurt workers. And the third way, modernized liberalism for political gain, of course, because Dukakis and Mondale and everybody were losing elections. Same with Tony Blair in the UK. But why not see it as genuine in that respect?
Because it didn't last. For example, the third way, Bill Clinton's greatest third way moment was when he signed welfare reform after vetoing it twice. President Obama undid a lot of the Bill Clinton welfare reform package that Mickey Kaus and others put together, taking the sugar coating off and adding, for example, repealing lifetime limits on welfare recipients. So I think he took the party back to a more genuine first-way approach. And the fourth way to me is, okay, he left the center, let's go take it and stay in the majority for a long period of time. Not sure that my conservative brethren will agree with me. It seems to me that President Trump began that way. Meeting yesterday with the building unions, Brian. That's a big deal.
We talked about it last hour and getting Bernie Sanders to come out on CNN last night and say nice things about him and said if he wants to, cancel trade agreements that aren't in the interest of American workers and do things like that, then I'm going to support him on those points even as I oppose him on others.
Yeah. The fourth way begins with the great inventor of the fourth way is actually Alexander Hamilton, but more recently, it's film director Rob Reiner. Rob passed Prop 10 in California 18 years ago, which took cigarette taxes and gave them to local people, and I've served on a Prop 10 board for 18 years, to use on infrastructure benefiting children 0 to 5 and make them healthy and ready to learn by the time they go to school.
This is fourth way? That doesn't sound conservative.
Oh, it's very conservative because it's 9 people from the local community who serve for no money with no bureaucratic oversight, and we do what we think is best for our community. It's federalism. And we've established dental clinics and swimming pools and autism centers. And if Donald Trump takes Rob Reiner's playbook, give the infrastructure funding that he has demanded and promised to local boards, and I argue this in the fourth way, he'll hit home run after home run. There will be tangible Trump trophies across the country.
You also pronounced George W. Bush's compassionate conservatism dead. Reaganism in pastels, you called it. Also ill-conceived, in your opinion?
No, I'm a big fan of W. I'm a Catholic social justice guy. And so when you merge conservative governance with Catholic social justice theology, you end up with W's compassionate conservatism and his father's 1,000 points of light. Never executed very well. Never executed very well.
Might not have wound up with the Iraq War, though, from a Catholic social justice perspective?
Well, I've had some conversations about that with people like Archbishop Chaput, and I haven't talked about it with Cardinal O'Connor, but it does seem to me just war does apply there, and it does not exclude Catholic social justice does not exclude robust national security actions.
One way or the other.
One way or the other. And it might not have been a wise decision. I won't replay it because we can't replay history, but it wouldn't exclude it necessarily.
And just to finish the thumbnail history, Obama, in the book, you call his policies disastrous. But he ends his time in office quite popular. And his supporters say, okay, Obamacare is flawed, but got 20 million people health insurance, needs to be fixed. The stimulus and even the TARP prevented the Great Recession from becoming another Great Depression, and he avoided getting the U.S. embroiled in yet another Middle East quagmire, despite the obvious horrors of Syria that everyone agrees are so horrific. So why disastrous from your point of view?
Well, let's start from the point of view of the Democratic Party. Down 12 senators in the Senate, down 54 members of Congress, down 14 state houses, down 900 legislative seats at the state and local
level. Politically disastrous.
In terms of the courts, the brokenness of the Senate process for confirming judges, the Harry Reid rule, which will now haunt Democrats, the simple majority approval, disastrous for the institutional check that the Senate has been. Disastrous even for the way that we talk to people. Now, Axelrod's my pal. He comes on my show a lot. I love to have him on. He's a Cubs fan. I'm an Indians fan.
Obama's old campaign manager.
Yeah, but I think the conversation sort of broke during President Obama's years. He began, if you'll recall, the week before he became president, meeting with George Will and Charles Krautheimer and Bill Kristol. And then the music stopped. The conversation ended. He told Eric Cantor famously, "We won, you lost." And there wasn't ever any bipartisanship. And that's why Obamacare doesn't work. It had no Republican input.
That we won, you lost. If I remember correctly, and maybe I don't, but that was at a televised meeting with Republicans in Congress after the pushback to the stimulus and maybe Obamacare had begun. And, you know, certainly the Democrats would say the conversation stopped when Mitch McConnell and the other leaders decided we won't go along with any kind of compromise on anything. Things that came out as formerly Republican-centrist, center-right policies like cap and trade and an individual mandate.
The famous McConnell statement, my objective, number one objective, beating him is 2 years after that meeting. You're right. It was televised. Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, and John Boehner were invited to the Oval or to the Roosevelt Room, I can't remember, to give their ideas. And Eric gave some ideas. Cantor gave some ideas. And the president said, no, we won, you lost. We're not doing that. Unfortunate. So was the entire 8 years of bitter partisanship. You cannot fix health care unless both parties agree. There are ways to do it. And by the way, the president's idea about extending children on their parents' insurance at 26 is going to get kept. I saw last night on Greta Van Susteren's show, Kevin Brady, who's chairman of Ways and Means, saying we're going to keep that. We're not going to allow people to exclude pre-existing conditions. But we're going to have a national marketplace, and we're going to slim down the mandatory benefits package. It could work, Brian. It could work. And I think Democrats might be more afraid of it working than it failing.
Hugh Hewitt is my guest. His new book is called The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. We can take some phone calls for him. Maybe you see him on television. Maybe you hear him on the radio. Maybe you just want to react to what you're hearing right now. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So how different from Reaganism is Fourth Way conservatism?
It's fairly significantly different. It does have the same defense buildup. President Trump has promised and will execute a 350-ship Navy, an expansion of the Marine Corps. I think General Mattis, General Flynn are superb appointments. But it is significantly different on trade. I am a free trader. I would have signed the TPP. I would have said, Yahoo, go on in. I don't believe in border adjustment taxes. I think that is a nightmare that gets close to Smoot-Hawley. There will be disagreements. So President Reagan, whom I served in the White House, you're kind enough to mention I was a young briefcase-carrying lawyer, sharing an office with the now Chief Justice, laboring away in obscurity when he was the smartest guy in the room. He didn't have to do much. He will be significantly alike on judges. So it's definitely a shotgun marriage of, and that's what the Fourth Way is all about. What do conservatives like me want from a nationalist like Donald Trump? And we can work together to, that's Hamiltonian. He is very Hamiltonian, and I'm looking forward to that.
You write that the Fourth Way is most pressingly about a rollback of the vast and growing regulatory state.
Yes.
And we saw President Trump put a moratorium on regulations as one of his first acts. Are there certain kind of regulations that you find the most onerous in a big picture way? Is there a way to put, you know, because there are a lot of listeners who don't work in industries that are regulated in a way that they feel. So they roll their eyes and they think, rollback regulations, that's just a sop to the owners to make more money relative to the safety of their workers or the environment. So what are these onerous regulations?
That's so observant. We work in a business that's not regulated.
Right.
You and I are in the First Amendment protected media, so we're not regulated. But I was a lawyer and still am for 30 years for landowners. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency are an iron triangle of non-development interests, and they prohibit the use of land. If you allow the use of land in a constructive way, not recklessly, but just in a constructive way, jobs are generated. For every house, for every construction industry job, there are four other jobs generated. Housing starts and building starts are the future. The building industry is to the country what GM and Ford and Chrysler were to the country in the 50s. We have to unleash it. Those three agencies in their obstacles to the productive use of land in an environmentally responsible way is the heart of the Fourth Way.
And you mentioned before the meeting between Trump and the construction union leaders yesterday. All of those leaders endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Right.
You call for spending on a specific sort of infrastructure. What sort?
I believe in buildings. I believe in public health clinics. I believe in swimming pools for underclass and underserved areas because of the lack of facilities that exist in places like Santa Ana, California, where we've poured a lot of money, or Garden Grove, California, or the Motel Children of Anaheim. I believe in the old school WPA, and I told the story this morning. My first job was in a WPA pool in Niles, Ohio. It's a WPA on it. It's still working.
That doesn't sound like Ronald Reagan.
It could be if you let local people decide what to do with their money. All you have to do is let local people decide. I asked my liberal friend, Jonathan Alter comes on. Jonathan, what happened to that $850 billion stimulus? Well, we repaved Route 3 in New Jersey. Show me a building, Brian. Can anything come to mind that is left behind of a $850 billion stimulus?
So you don't mind spending the $850 billion, maybe especially under those dire economic circumstances, but it should have been left more to the local communities, or I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, you're getting close. It went to bureaucracy and not to buildings. It went to pension funds and to organized labor, especially in the public sector, and not to buildings. And so I think it was a waste. And I don't want to spend $850 billion. Leader Schumer unveiled a new $1 trillion stimulus yesterday. I think you could accomplish 100 times as much with a tenth of the money. I would like to see about an $85 billion stimulus.
So is Trump for the kind of infrastructure that you've just been talking about. I think there are some liberal skeptics who say, oh, yeah, he talks about infrastructure, but really all he's going to do is green light pipelines and things like that that the private sector want to build, and it's not going to be public works or public interest infrastructure.
He talks primarily about ports and airports. The pipelines will be approved today, two executive orders, the North Dakota pipeline and XL. But I think he talks mostly about ports and airports, and I think that's fine, but I want more.
He says bridges, railroads, he says that.
Yeah, and those are all fine, but I think your payoff is the Carnegie Library. You know, Andrew Carnegie built 1,600 of those in the United States. They've been repurposed. They're still around. People don't use libraries anymore. Build buildings that serve people, especially
people in New York.
Underclass.
I just have to say, people in New York use libraries a lot.
Yeah, do they? Because in my Carnegie Library in Warren, Ohio, has been repurposed three times, and I spend every Tuesday night, as I write in the Fourth Way, going to that library. And I think if you build brick and mortar, and one of my examples is the Neighborhood Christian Clinic in Phoenix, cost $1 million to build, so it serves 14,000 people a year. The old public health model, Brian, works. We ought to go back to delivering health care, not paper, to people.
My guest is Hugh Hewitt. His book is The Fourth Way, the conservative playbook for a lasting GOP majority. And Charlie in Deal. You're on WNYC with Hugh Hewitt. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning.
Morning, Charlie.
I'm just concerned. I heard a lot of beautiful stuff so far. But how do you – I know you supported Trump and you campaigned for him – how do you feel about the tone of what's going on and the amount of people that it's making them so uncomfortable? Thank you. I'll hang up.
Thank you, Charlie. I think it's a really important question.
It's the question. The more we talk about temperament, the less we talk about tangible Trump trophies. And I'm very uncomfortable. That's why I asked him to step out of the race after the Access Hollywood video. As I said, I am not comfortable with this approach. I have interviewed him a number of times, 15 times on the radio, four debates. In private, he is very different than this public persona, and I believe he will accomplish much, much more to the extent that he limits the explosiveness, the Andrew Jacksonian kind of thunder.
Let me follow up on that, because I think there's a sense of betrayal that a lot of people feel, like maybe especially a lot of women and Muslims and people of color who might feel that a thoughtful conservative like yourself wouldn't find Trump's disparaging of the Khan family and Judge Curiel and women on the Billy Bush tape and, you know, Megyn Kelly and the disabled reporter and the Seventh-day Adventists and pretending not to know who David Duke was and on for the sake of political gain, that that should have all been morally disqualifying to someone like you who seems to have real standards and decency. What would you say to those people?
First, I'd tell them I have my own Trump tattoos. I was insulted publicly by the president in front of 21 million people, and this is the business we have chosen, as said in Godfather III. You just Godfather II, you just take it and you go along. Number two,
but that's media, like politician to media person. That's different than how vulnerable populations feel.
And vulnerable populations, I think, should watch what he does. I've urged everyone when they go back and reread the inaugural, which is growing on me. The most important thing he said is we will eradicate radical Islamic terrorism from the face of the earth. That's a hard thing to do, but everyone would agree it would be a good thing to do, including Muslims.
Why is that the most important? Because everybody says that, right? I mean, President Bush and President Obama both said we were going to wipe this out, right?
President Obama never actually said it. That was part of the campaign, and people doubted whether or not he had the tenacity to actually carry through the abrupt withdrawal from Iraq, et cetera. But I do believe that the march was a reaction to language. And the march was huge, and the march is significant, and people ought to look at it and say, okay, what do I do? And I said, when he talked about American Carnage, though, Brian, the Oscars came out today. I think the best film of the year is Moonlight by about 1 million yards. And Moonlight is about American Carnage. It is about a neighborhood that I don't go to, that I don't live in, that I try hard to serve through the commissions I serve on. But it is American Carnage to be a gay kid growing up with a crackhead mother. That is American Carnage, to live in that neighborhood that's depicted in that movie. And if Trump can address those problems, will they look past his language to his achievements? I hope they would.
I'm interviewing Michael Moore later, and I was thinking that some of the language, including some of the American Carnage and dark portrayals of, you know, rusted out factories and all of that, is language that somebody like a Michael Moore could use.
Oh, yes. In fact, Michael Moore, I would like him to describe Warren, Ohio, with its shuttered copper weld, U.S. Steel and Republic Steel, with its closed down Packard plant with GM running on two shifts and not three. What happened to Trumbull and Mahoning County? They've only voted for a Republican twice since 1928. They voted for Hoover. They voted for Richard Nixon in 72, and then they voted for Trump. Why did they do that? Because Michael Moore had the same analysis of the problem, and they think Trump will fix it.
Judy in Port Washington, you're on WNYC with Hugh Hewitt. Hi, Judy.
Thank you. I would appreciate Mr. Hewitt's honesty more if he would honestly acknowledge the wall of racism that met President Obama for 8 years. A man standing up during a State of the Union address and shouting, "You lie," and nobody criticized that from the Republican Party. Mitch McConnell swearing to be in opposition for 8 years. And then when Obama does things like adopt a Republican health care plan that was invented by, I understand it, Mitt Romney, everybody shouted Obamacare was the worst thing since the plague. And it's like cooties. Anything Obama said had cooties. Because he was black, and if Mr. Hewitt can't acknowledge this, I can't believe him about anything else.
I think you do disagree with this.
I do, and Judy, thank you for the call. I do reject that. I only know my own heart, and it's got nothing to do with race that I opposed Obamacare. If you would look up, if you have the time, Judy, Google Hugh Hewitt, the completion, the column that I wrote about President Obama's swearing in 8 years ago. It was an important triumph for American democracy. It was an important triumph for the 14th Amendment. Much of the opposition to President Obama, I'm not denying there are racists in America. I think they're a small and insignificant number, but I'm not denying that they are there. The opposition to President Obama was based on ideology, not race. And I would point out to the fact that Secretary Powell, Secretary Rice, the whole legacy of the Republican commitment to the civil rights movement that dates back to my state of Ohio, free soil state, and breaking the Southern Democratic bloc on the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, it's just not true that it was based on race. It's based on ideology, a huge difference.
But it's not just Obama's black, I don't like black people. It trickles down, the people who disagree with you would say, to, you know, views like, oh, this Obamacare, it's going to give my tax dollars to a lot of undeserving black people disproportionately when I'd rather it stay in the fund for my Medicare. That might have been a Tea Party position, consciously or subconsciously.
And I would say to them, I hope they read The Fourth Way. Most conservatives, I don't deny there's a nationalist, racist element of about 1% on the margin, just like there's a crazy communist element of about 1% on the margin. And we've got to move away from the amplification of the margins to the center of the debate, which occurs in Congress primarily between the left and the right. And to amplify everything into a debate over race is to do a disservice to those people who are trying to help, regardless of color, ethnicity, religion, background, those who need help.
On Obamacare, you write in the book about the possible transition that you hope for back to free markets in healthcare. But what do you say to criticism that healthcare almost by definition can't work as a free market commodity because the sickest people are so expensive, they'll almost always go broke paying their bills. And that's why whether it's a tax-funded high-risk pool or an individual mandate on the young and healthy so that they buy insurance and put money in the system, government has to play a significant socializing role in the health realm.
I used to regulate the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, my last job in the Reagan administration. It suffered from adverse selection, which is a result of annual open seasons. That meant the sickest people picked the best plans when they got sick. That's not insurance. That's actually a disaster, and we subsidized it heavily. The secret is a national marketplace, and President Trump would talk about erasing the lines. I knew what he meant. He meant one marketplace. You go to Jeff Bezos and say, if you can make 3 billion deliveries in a year, could you design me a website that makes every policy in America available from which no one can be excluded on the basis of pre-existing condition, make it easy to understand, visible, and the pricing apparent. We'll help those people out who can't afford it. It isn't that hard to do, but you must lower the minimum benefit package. You can't make me, as a 60-year-old white male, pay for birth control. I don't need it. I don't want it. And I shouldn't have to pay for it. So I think it will work if the market is actually allowed to form.
But how do you take care of those people who need the help? The, you know, a lot of Trump voters, right? The stereotype of a Trump voter is like a 55-year-old white guy who's working class and now underemployed. That's a lot of Obamacare subsidized policyholders.
Means testing credits for the purchase of health care is a huge deal. And it's one of Ryan's ideas. It's one of Tom Price's ideas. I shouldn't be getting a subsidy for my health care, but a lot of people should be. We but just ought to make it simple.
That's exactly what Obamacare does. Means testing subsidy for buying insurance.
No. What it does is mandate a huge benefit package on the back of every single participant in the individual pools, which is why, by the way, they're in a death spiral. People will rather pay the tax penalty because they viewed it as an economically beneficial transaction than to get a $6,000 deductible policy.
Let me take one more call for you. It's interesting. Of all the things that you've said, the thing that's really got the phones going is your criticism of President Obama's legacy. So we'll take one more like that. Jack in Highland. You're on WNYC. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Brian. I don't even know where to begin.
Okay, Jack.
In the first place,
pick a focus point and make it.
Gas is down. The stock market's up. Unemployment is down. There are more people insured in the country than there have ever been. So Mr. Hewitt, your entire premise is demonstrably false from the get-go. And I have one question. Considering all the misogyny, the racism, the hatred that Trump has been preaching, is there any line, sir, that he could cross that would make you not support him? What could he possibly do after what he's already done? Thank you, Brian.
The last chapter of the fourth way is about impeachment. And it is for this reason I included it, because there are guardrails which, if he crosses, Republicans have actually impeached one of their own. Democrats refused to do so. Republicans actually impeached Richard Nixon for abuse of power. If President Trump were to abuse power, and I do not believe he will, I would expect the Republicans to impeach him, which I hope they don't have to do it. But I would say to Jack, just a couple of things, Jack. Aleppo is a word. I sum up the Obama presidency in six words. All right. Leading from behind, red line, and Aleppo. I could substitute JB's for Aleppo.
That's all foreign war policy.
It's all foreign war policy. And the disaster that has befallen the globe as a result of 8 years of Ben Rhodes and Valerie Jarrett and President Obama is profound and will take a long time to dig out. At home, one has to look at underemployment as well as unemployment. There was an interesting question at the press conference yesterday. What's the unemployment rate? And I thought Sean Spicer did a fine job, said it is what the Bureau of Labor Statistics says, but that doesn't tell you the story of underemployment. And I know people who are underemployed. And I think if Andy Pusner is confirmed, you will be shocked at what happens to American labor markets. They will improve so dramatically.
In that impeachment chapter, you cited the David Brooks column just after the election where he said, this is only going to last six months to a year anyway. I could see a scenario, I've mentioned this before too, that because Trump has been so close to the line of the Republicans in Congress turning on him and doing what you did, calling for him to drop out of the race, because he flirts with being so politically toxic that it's really bad for the party, that if something were to come up, I don't know if it's collaborations with the Russians that gets revealed from the campaign or some other sort of racist thing that he does or whatever it is, more than any president I could think of, he enters teetering on the line, you know, around which the Republicans could desert him and
vote
for him.
You're very perceptive. The Emoluments Clause controversy, which will not have legs with a Republican majority because it is indeed ambiguous what it applies to. George Washington referred to it in his first inaugural address in a way that clearly does not mean fair market transactions with foreign governments. So I think Professor Tribe, with whom I've discussed this, is wrong. Nevertheless, if you lose the Congress in a wipeout in 2018 because you are toxic, they will not hesitate to bring those articles based on the Emolument Clause or any other abuse of power. And that's what I wrote in the fourth way. I want to be very clear-eyed about this. He's got to adapt to what you rightly identified as the thin ice on which he skates.
Later, I'm interviewing Fareed Zakaria, who's among those concerned that Trump will move us toward authoritarian, illiberal democracy, with populism and corporate power both rising, he writes, and community-building power of political parties and the pushback power of the press falling. The thinning out of democracy is a real risk, he says. What do you think?
Fareed's a very smart guy, but I believe in the fourth way, the chapter about judges should allay his fear. When Neil Gorsuch is nominated this week, or David Pryor, or any, or Mike Lee, or any of the 21, an originalist goes onto the bench. When 103 other judges are confirmed under the Reed rule by simple majority, they will all be originalists. They're being advised by Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society and Jim DeMint of the Heritage Foundation. Originalists check power. They do not expand it. They do not encourage the use of the pen and the phone as President Obama did. They will rebuke that for him. And he is committed to originalists. And the quickest way to lose his Republican support is to appoint liberal judges. He's not going to do that. So he is going to build the wall that is necessary around executive abuse of power through his own judicial appointments.
Interesting. All right. So I also host a Tuesday night national call-in show starting tonight for the first 100 days of the administration, and it's about getting people out of their bubbles. And I hope you'll come on that show some week and take calls from around the country across political lines.
Anytime, Brian.
For hopefully something more enlightening than debate, which is what the country needs so badly right now. And I appreciate you coming on today.
I appreciate you having me. We run the same show on different networks, and I appreciate your approach.
Hugh Hewitt, his new book is The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. His radio talk show is heard locally on AM 970, and he's an NBC News and MSNBC commentator. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you, Brian.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. You know, Wall Street has a longstanding reputation of being mostly a boys' club. Our next guest, Sally Krawcheck, knows that firsthand. She rose to power as the CEO of Smith Barney, then CEO of Merrill Lynch, and then CFO of Citigroup. And she's used to being the only woman in the room. But she's trying to change all that. Now she's the CEO of Elevest, a digital investment platform designed to help women reach their financial goals. And she's got a new book, Own It, The Power of Women at Work, where she offers a new set of rules for women to be successful in the workplace. She writes, "We women are on the brink of extraordinary rise. The future is ours to seize." She was also seizing it in part by attending the Women's March on Washington last weekend. Sally Krawcheck, welcome to WNYC.
Brian, I'm so glad to be here with you. I'm the only woman in this room.
You are the only woman out of the two people in this room. But at least that's 50% representation, which is the same as in the population.
There we go.
But it always seems like books are coming out saying, "We women are on the brink of extraordinary rise." And then the brink never comes.
That, fair enough. And in fact, the book really starts with, weren't we supposed to be here already? Weren't we supposed to have arrived? With all the discussion around women in business, it just felt like we had momentum. But we've stalled in corporate America, despite the fact that when you have gender diverse leadership teams, the companies perform better, and not by a little bit, by quite a bit. But we've stalled in some industries where you might think more women would be helpful, like Wall Street. We've gone backwards.
Why backwards on Wall Street, and how much?
Well, it's not atypical for an industry that goes through a crisis to become less diverse on the other side, the circling of wagons. I saw it not in a, oh, let's get rid of people of difference, but more, hey, things are so tough, I need someone I can trust. And the person I can trust looks just like me. And that's just human nature. But, you know, the industry went into the downturn white male and middle-aged and came out whiter, maler, and middle-ageder. I love white middle-aged males. I always say I've been married to a couple of them. But there's a lot of research. The opposite of the research of how women help businesses is when you have homogenous groups, they tend to, and it's been shown in capital markets, they tend to trust each other too much, misprice the markets. A lot of testosterone is a lot of risk-taking. And in this case, poor risk-taking. And it really almost brought the economy down.
So why have you been the exception? I mean, you've been CEO of Merrill Lynch, CFO of Citigroup.
Yeah. A lot of hard work, but a lot of doing things my own way, which has been good for me and bad for me. So when I ran Sanford Bernstein, which was a research business, I took us out of investment banking. We were doing research, so we were working for one client. The investment banking business was a conflict of interest. It had you work for another client in direct opposition. I took us out. Elliot Spitzer came in, found out the industry had these conflicts. We ended up as the biggest business out of it, and my career soared for having this very contrarian position. And I attribute that in part because I was so different. On the other hand, I got fired. When I was running Smith Barney, I was the only executive on Wall Street, to the best of my knowledge, to return client funds because we'd messed up. And I got fired for it. Managed to do it, but I got fired for it. And so the argument I make in the book is these points of difference. Maybe I was right and maybe I was wrong, but wouldn't we want Wall Street to have had more of these debates as opposed to fewer?
And you describe in the book the aha moment that was triggered for you by being fired.
Oh, yes. So I've had several of them. But But one of them, you know, it's funny, Brian, after I got booted out, people said to me, well, you should start a investing business for women. And I would say, you should jump off of a cliff. Because I had been brought up in an environment in which that was a junior varsity thing. It had to be dumbed down, simplified. But step back. The retirement savings crisis in this country is a woman's crisis. We live 5, 6 years, 8 years longer than you men do. We're 80% of nursing home residents. We retire with 2/3 the money of men. If we have a crisis, it's a woman's crisis. We love you, but you're going to be dead. Okay? Now, how do you solve it? We typically think tax increases, entitlement cuts. But you know what? If we close the gender pay gap, we close the retirement savings gap by a third. If we close the gender investing gap, women don't invest as much as men do, in part because Wall Street is so male. We get to women hundreds of thousands, some women millions of dollars more over the course of their lives, if history is any guide.
So is that what you're working on at your current company? Do you say LVEST?
LVEST. So French, ELLEVEST. Yes. So I got over myself and I said, so to back up and get Gloria Steinem on us, we women have plenty of resources. We have $5 trillion of investable assets. We direct 80% of consumer spending. But on an individual basis, we have less money than the men do. Until we are financially equal with you, we will not be equal with you. And that's when I began to think, you know what? Wall Street is failing women. And we're telling them, you know, it's your fault, lady. You know, you're not as good at math. You're not as good an investor, neither of which is true. You need more financial education. Okay, but so do the guys. And as I stepped back and said, it's such a male business. The industry symbol is a bull. Mm. Phallic symbol, right?
You want it to be a cow?
No, never call a woman a cow. Financial advisors are 86% male and on average about 60 years old. And I said, there's got to be a better way. And so we put together an online platform that the least of it is that it's beautiful. But what it does is it takes into account, as no one else does, that we women live longer, that our salaries emerge differently, that women can take financial breaks. And so we need something different. And we think about investing differently. Not a single one woman told me she wanted to outperform the S&P. Every other woman, and we've spoken to maybe hundreds, thousands at this stage, say, I want to retire well. I want to buy a home. I want a big splurge. We think of it conceptually. We don't think of it as just making more money.
My guest is Sally Krawcheck. Her new book is Own It, The Power of Women at Work. And we can take your phone calls for her at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. On that point you were just making, you probably saw the New York Times article yesterday about how women are dropping out of the workplace for different reasons than men. Economist mm-hmm. Nicholas Eberstadt identified what he called a care chasm as a reason for that happening in the U.S. compared to other industrialized countries, which have better policies to prevent this sort of thing. What do you think of that idea?
I think he's right. And I think it cost us more than we realize. So if I were to say, we do it for babies, we do it for parents, we still are the main caregivers and we're still the main worriers. We talk about the unpaid labor gap. I wish my husband would wake up in the middle of the night as much as I do, worried that our kids aren't home for the curfew, right? Mm-hmm. The amount of sleep I've lost versus him is something. But the career break, so let me give you some quick numbers. If a woman's making $85,000 a year, she takes a 2-year career break, and I were to say to you, Brian, how much does that cost her? You do the calculation, say $170,000. The number's 1.7 million over the course of her life. Why? Because on average, when she comes back to the workforce, she takes a substantial pay cut. She's not investing in her 401k. Any raise she gets later is off of a lower rate. And so these costs are enormous. Now, perhaps some of your gentlemen listeners are thinking, well, that's a woman's problem, right? But closing these gender gaps helps everybody. I would ask your gentlemen listeners, do you have any women customers, right? Or women clients? You know, do you have daughters? So if we can get
or if women, the woman is your wife, that's family income.
That's a good thing, right? Or a sister. I mean, the women – doing better, women having more money is a win, 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 win. Economy, society, families, everybody.
So is this a matter primarily of changing federal policy, changing male attitudes? What's the biggest thing that would bring this about?
Well, it wouldn't hurt to have a mandated parental leave because women really fall out of the workforce when they have those babies. And there is research, new research, that shows that a parental leave can pay – a maternal leave can pay for itself in the first year because women return to work, so you don't have to replace them. You don't have to train their replacement. Here's what I think is going to happen, and here's the optimistic note on the book, which is – we talked about women, the advancement stalling in business. There's a big difference today. It's called technology. It's changing the workplace. It is changing what it takes to be successful in the workplace. In the day, Jack Welch, command and control, I have the information, you don't. Today, we've all got the information. And some of the skills that women bring of risk awareness, holistic decision making, seeing around corners, valuable stuff. If companies don't pay them or value it, when I was younger, I would go in and say, hey, can I have a raise? They'd say no. I'd say, okay. Today, you can go in and say, hey, this is how much I should make. I know because technology has given me payscale.com, get raised, hired, comparably. If they won't, I used to have to go to another company or go home. Little information. Today, I can go to another company. I can look at crowdsourced information about their company culture. I can compare on something like Fairy Godboss, their parental leaves. And then finally, if I don't want to do that, rather than go home, I can start my own thing. The cost of starting businesses is plummeting today. Women are starting businesses at 2x the rate of men. And the main reason for doing it is because they want to build the cultures at which they want to work. And the fourth option is to have a non-traditional career, part-time consulting. So all of a sudden, whereas before it's the company's way or the highway, we women have got a lot more options and are beginning to take advantage of them.
Tanya in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Sally Krawcheck. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, hi, hi to both of you guys. I love your show.
Thank you.
Listen, I'm a woman. You know how with the 401k plan, which she was speaking upon, my job contributes 12%. My rationale was, okay, I put 3% towards it to make it an even 15%, but I don't know, should I be contributing a little more? Because I don't know what it is about the 15% registering with me with the 401k plan, but what can I do to help myself? I'm like 42 years old now.
That's great. Good. Well, I love it that you're contributing to it. I love it that your company is contributing to it for you.
Right.
In my opinion, you should put in as much as you can afford.
Okay.
Because you sound like a woman who's exercising and taking care of herself. And if you're going to live a longer life, you need to plan for that longer life. I like the 401k plan too, besides the tax deferral.
Right.
It comes out of your paycheck, so you don't even know it's going.
Exactly.
And it forces you to invest regularly. So when the market's ups and downs, some markets you'll be investing in will be expensive, others will be cheap, but you'll get a market-like return over time, which is so much better than leaving it in cash.
Tanya, thank you, and good luck.
Tanya, you rock.
Emily in Newburgh, you're on WNYC. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I was calling about a question that I had having to do with sort of what you think some tactics are for training men or training men in male-dominated workplaces to understand the benefits of having a more diverse workforce, specifically training men to understand the benefits of having a woman who's more inclined, like you said, to bring up sort of the concerns about risk or high-risk environments. I worked as a woman in a male-dominated fabrication company, and I was one of three women probably out of 40.
Right. So I love the term you use, train them. I think that's amazing. I talk about, first of all, I give them a copy of the book, Own It, because there's all sorts of data and research in the beginning, which I hope is presented in a not boring way, but a pretty fast read about the great things that all kinds of diversity does for businesses, but gender diversity in particular. The other concept that I talk about in the book is the courageous conversation. What conversation are you willing to have at work? I'm willing to write a book about this, other people are willing to, on a daily basis, say, hey, Peter, do you realize you interrupted Susie in that meeting five times, but you didn't interrupt Joe? Or, hey, Sam, do we realize we just promoted Mike while we called him ambitious and he broke eggs, but we advised, you know, Cynthia to get, you know, an executive coach? Bring in these topics up. We have to as women. I always hear we got to bring the men in more, where the men need to take a leading role. The truth is I've probably worked with more men than anyone. I've probably interrupted more men having more conversations about stuff than anyone. Never once did I walk into a conference room and say, hey, guys, what are y'all talking about? And they said, hey, Sally, funny at you. We were just talking about the positive impact of gender diversity and driving performance. Never happened. So we've got to bring up these courageous conversations, but I'd give them the book or look in the back of the book for the resources. I'd hand them some pieces of paper, and then I'd have the courage to start these conversations at work. And the worst thing that happens is it doesn't work, and then you go work someplace else that gets it.
My guest is Sally Krawchak, who has been CEO of Smith Barney, CEO of Merrill Lynch, CFO of Citigroup. She's currently the CEO of Elevest, and she has a new book called Own It, The Power of Women at Work. And Tim in Westfield, you're on WNYC. Hello, Tim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
On WNYC, there's been a lot of negative rhetoric about President Trump, but I think I could bring you guys a little bit of positive. During the campaign, President Trump spoke about child care, and so did his daughter, Ivanka. And, we could maybe put the head of crony capitalist Krawchak and nationalist Trump together and maybe get something going there.
All right. Capitalist. Are you a crony capitalist Krawchak?
I don't know. It's Krawchak.
Krawchak.
I hear you. I know. I was heartened by the fact that he brought that up. I was heartened by the fact that his daughter has brought that up, and we'd all love to see it. I think it would be a really important step.
There was a difference on the campaign trail that was discussed between the Hillary Clinton plan for paid family leave and the Trump plan, that the Trump plan was inferior as the Democrats saw it because it was only maternal leave. It wasn't parental leave, so it didn't actually give fathers the incentive to take time off from the workplace, which would generally, you know, be a boon to women's equality, and also was shorter. Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, there's research that indicates that men having these parental leaves as well is good for the families, certainly good for the kids, also good for the women's compensation and earnings as well. It normalizes the idea of family leave as something that we do as people, not that that other group over there, those women do. The truth is, I'm a pragmatist. If we can get anything, fantastic, because we're the only developed country in the world and only one of two countries in the world that don't have these leaves. I have had babies. It is painful. It takes a while to recover from. And you know, if you're just a human, you want to get that kid off on the right foot. And it's shameful that we don't have that in this country and that something like only 20% of companies have it. I mean, how do you return to work right after that?
Should we go full Sweden and require that men take a percentage of the family leave? Otherwise, the family loses some of it?
I haven't gotten all the way there, but yeah, let's debate it over a glass of wine later.
And you write in the book about how you are back at work just 2 weeks after having a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Do you regret that?
So I had two different experiences. After my son was born, I took off almost 10 or 11 months and was with him and had a very important insight. That was my first.
Okay.
Had a very important insight, which I'm not a great stay-at-home mom. You know, we were well on our way to neurotic baby, right? I was teaching him to crawl, and I thought, this is not good for any of us. So that's when I got over the guilt about the stay-at-home versus work. And with my daughter, yeah, I certainly wish I'd had more than 2 weeks. But I was starting a new job. I was new in my career. I wanted to make a great impression. Don't worry, I make it up to her now. We spend a lot of time together. Too much, she thinks.
Wendy in New Canaan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. So, hi, Sally. I have a couple questions for you. One is that, I am a stay-at-home mom to two kids. I've been doing this for over 3 years, and I used to be an interest rate trader on Wall Street, and I was one of 50, the only one in there. And so I think, you know, when you talk about bringing more women into Wall Street, into the industry, particularly on the trading side, a lot of the stuff is, you know, Wall Street is as a meritocracy as it gets in some sense. So a lot of the stuff, you know, how far you go is largely dependent on your performance, on your P&L. So when you're talking about bringing in women to close that gender gap, are you proposing that, you know, we're giving people sort of a women bonus, you know, your P&L might not be as high as the next man, but because we want to close the gender gap, you know, we kind of just, you know,
is that,
ignore the P&L aspect.
So Wendy, is that really right? Because I'll tell you, the businesses that I had responsibility for, the wealth management business, the research businesses, the women didn't have smaller P&Ls than the men did. In fact, we found at the wealth management businesses that our most successful, some good number of our most successful advisors were women. And what I found is that when we stripped out the gendered stuff from it, the I think Joe is great, he's very firm, he's terrific, and we just looked at the numbers, that we ended up promoting far more women and people of color than the management team had recommended to start with. So I often recommend to women, particularly if you're going to be on Wall Street, try to find a job that has got numbers attached to it, because in my experience running these businesses, women do amazingly well.
Okay, that's interesting. That's a little bit different from my experience, yep. But I'm glad to hear that.
Well, then I would argue, by the way, on the trading floor, you and I both know. We know this intuitively. The research strongly indicates it, that if those trading floors on Wall Street had been not as many, and we love them, Caucasian, male, middle-aged traders with the same educational backgrounds, the same training programs, in our mind, we can picture people of color, people of difference, more women. You and I both intuitively know that that downturn would have been less severe than it was. And the research backs this up.
Wendy, thank you for your call. You write about being a queen bee in the office, and you describe being queen beed.
I was never a queen bee.
That's or maybe the topic of being a queen bee. And so you found in your research that women don't have as much of a tendency to support one another as you would think that they might, given history.
Well, and it made economic sense that if you were a senior woman at a company that has one woman at the executive table and always has, and you're not ready to give it up, you better not help someone else. There's also research that shows historically that if women have advocated for other women or people of color for people of color, we've had our reputations dinged. This is where we need to have a courageous conversation. And the research shows that it works, that I should say, I want to advocate for Wendy. And the research would show you will dismiss me, but let me tell you why Wendy's the right person. And we women have to fight for more seats at the table. Smart companies are realizing that more seats at the table for people of difference leads to better businesses. We need to fight for it. And if the companies won't give it to us, again, we have the opportunity today to go start our own businesses and go away from those that are, you know, not fully embracing the beauty of difference that the workforce
couple of
offers.
Things yeah. On the news. When you were writing this book, most of the country, most of the world was thinking we were about to have our first female president. Does the fact of Trump's election change the context for your book in any way?
You know, it's interesting. It does. And women, what I am hearing from women again and again and again is, you know what, Sally? We need to do something different. We need to take action. That idea, I start the book with, I don't like the term empowerment. And I never knew why, but empowerment means to be given power. Mm. And this idea that what we're doing is going to work and we're on our way, we have got slammed into a wall, whether it's politics, whether it's business right now. And so women are increasingly saying, what can we do that's different? And some of it is the smaller stuff, the courageous conversation, but some of it's the bigger stuff, which is, I'm not going to buy from companies that don't advance women. I'm not going to invest in companies that don't advance women. And I'm going to friggin' not work for companies the Don't Advance Women. I'm going to start my own thing. And so there's more of a sense of energy around this than I really expected.
And as a serial investment bank CEO, what do you think of Dow 20,000?
Who cares? You know, there's a whole, like a whole big deal. It's 20,000. It's like, that's so different from 19,999 or 20,001. So we get caught on these round numbers. It's the Dow. It's not the whole market. You know, look, what it has proven to me yet again is that nobody knows what's going to happen in the markets. Not many people thought Trump would be elected. And if he was, not many people thought the market would go up. And that goes back to what we advocated Elevest, which is don't try to time the market. Even the best investor on the planet, Warren Buffett, doesn't try to time the market. Invest steadily. Invest in low-cost ETFs, diversified portfolios. You know, don't try to buy and sell. It's a loser's game. Just steady as she goes.
It's not just the Dow. The S&P and the NASDAQ hit records this week. And so do you not look at – I mean, you know, somebody could just buy some Vanguard funds if they weren't going to take any guesses at management. So do you look at do you do sort of risk management on what you think Donald Trump is going to mean for investments long term?
Us? Nobody knows the answer to it. So what exactly do you risk manage? That's, again, why you don't invest in the S&P only. You invest in a diversified investment portfolio that includes bonds, which can often move in a different direction than stocks, that includes international exposure, that has some cash in it, that could include some real estate. That's what the beauty of diversification, because you and I both know nobody knows what Donald Trump is going to do. And mm-hmm. So to try to risk manage around that, forget it. And you have a long-term perspective. For most people, their investment portfolio will go out more than the years or time that he will be in office. In general, the economy grows over time. The global economy grows over time. And being an investor has been a winning strategy over time.
Sally Krawcheck is now CEO of Elevest and author of the new book, Own It, The Power of Women at Work. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.